Looks like we have some version of a kind of partial, maybe, trade deal? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, October 11th. Good to have you with us. We've got some new details today on the broad outlines of a trade deal with China. Or partial deal, I think. Maybe? President Trump is calling this phase one of a larger deal. According to the few details we have so far, this phase will stall some of the tariffs that were set to kick in next week. But to unpack this and the rest of the week's financial news, we've got Dion Rabowan of Axios and Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. They're both in our New York studio. Hey, you two.
Hey, how's it going?
What's going on, Kimberly?
So, Dion, let's start with you. What else is in this?
What else is in this? Well, everything. Everything you ever wanted.
No. Oh, come on, Dion. Don't
do this to me.
Let me love this trade deal. Let's do broad outlines.
Okay. So, look, the big thing is it seems like there may be some actual movement on this intellectual property issue. You've got commitments to buy some more soybeans and pork by the Chinese. You've also got, a rollback of the tariffs that were set to come on this Tuesday. Those aren't going to be put in place. So, you know, it's not the best news. What the market really wants is for the tariffs to just go away, be rolled back entirely. But it's certainly not bad news.
The stress on our economy as it stands now will remain. This deal means that things simply aren't going to get worse, and the 30% tariffs that were supposed to be enacted on the 15th will not go into place. However, this deal doesn't actually really deal with anything that the 302 investigation into China's theft of intellectual property and other abuses of American corporations was actually supposed to handle. So again, this is kind of a Band-Aid on the kind of bullet wound in the relationship that the Trump administration created.
Like you said,
and
it's not going to get worse.
It looks like the deal that we made last December, which kind of paused a trade war for a couple months, and then it brought it back with a vengeance when talks to get to a more advanced stage collapsed.
Well, Dion, I know you're optimistic about this, but it's not written yet. It's an agreement in principle. The Trump and President Xi are supposed to sign it together, I guess, at some point. How real is this?
It's certainly real. Liu He is a big player in China. President Trump was obviously in the room.
And this is who Trump was meeting today.
Yeah, Vice Premier Liu He from China is who Trump was meeting. So again, it's not like these are some low-level lieutenants like some of the trade talks that we've had in months past. This is, you know, big folks. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin came out and made an announcement that the tariffs that were scheduled to go in place on the 15th aren't going to come out. I do want to make clear, though, I'm sort of trolling with my excitement about this deal because it is a nothing deal. But
it's big folks making small deals.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, what we were supposed to do was make a big deal with China. Now, the market will probably heave something of a sigh of relief, and it isn't going to make central bankers more nervous. But we're already in a position where it looks like the economy is starting to deteriorate.
Right, but again,
you're
treating this trade war as if it was a needed war, as if it was something that had to be done.
It's completely unnecessary.
All right, you guys.
But that's not the point here.
Since Lynette mentioned central bankers, let's turn to the Fed. Dion, we got Fed minutes this week. Clearly, folks were divided about that last rate cut. So to steal Kai's line, what is Jay Powell thinking?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually wrote about this in the newsletter this week. Jay Powell is very clearly trying to communicate that the market and that the economy and the country are in good shape. He gave a speech at the National Association of Business Economists meeting in Denver. I was there. He's very clearly trying to make sure that everyone knows that everything is okay. Anytime someone asks him, hey, what about the trade war? Or hey, what about these manufacturing numbers that are declining or in recession? What about the transportation industry that's in recession? He says, you know, yeah, that's bad. But look here. Look at jobs. Look at the rest of the strong economy. And he's very much making a point to communicate with regular folks out there that, you know what, you may have heard some bad things, but really everything is all right. And we're just cutting rates right now because we need to do a mid-cycle adjustment. We're trying to add a little bit of insurance. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
Oh, yeah, but the minutes don't say that. The Fed minutes have shown that all the central bankers from around the country are becoming more and more concerned about how the economy is going, and especially with the number we just saw out of the services sector, which was one of our big surveys of the services sector of this economy, which is about 80%.
70.
Okay, fine.
also, whatever. Still an expansion. Whatever. Services still an expansion.
Still an expansion, but slowing down.
All right. That was Lynette Lopez of Business Insider and Dion Raboan of Axios. Thank you, you two, for stopping the fighting eventually.
We do what we can, Kimberly.
It's a contentious time.
All right. On Wall Street, you know the markets just loved getting this news just before the close. We will have those details when we do the numbers. As Dion and Lynette were just saying, it's hard to pin down just where the economy is headed. And stop me if you've heard us say this before, there's always you, the American consumer. Despite the trade war, the impeachment investigation, even warning signs of a possible recession, most consumers seem to think the economy is doing just fine right now. According to the monthly survey out today from the University of Michigan, consumer sentiment climbed to its highest point in 3 months. Marketplace's Erica Barris explains some of the reasons why consumers are feeling flush.
First reason, lower mortgage interest rates, thanks to the Federal Reserve. Towards the end of last year, they peaked at a little over 5%. Today, they're just under 4%, says Mark Hamrick of Bankrate.com.
On a $200,000 loan, which is a number that is close to the median price of a home in the United States, including whatever down payment there might be, that saves $150 a month.
Rates on credit cards and car loans haven't fallen as much. But even so, consumers are spending more on the cars they're buying, says Ivan Drury with Edmunds. And that brings us to the second reason. The survey found consumers are feeling flush. They're not as worried about the trade war. For example, Drury says the effects of tariffs aren't really showing up on the sticker prices of cars.
A lot of the cost is still being absorbed by the automaker. I think when we talk about steel tariffs from over a year ago, all the automakers essentially took in that cost on their own. They didn't pass it on down to the consumers.
Third reason, the survey found that people think they'll make more money next year. Matt Slaughter is an economist at Dartmouth College.
I think a lot of the confidence that people have about now and the future is more related to how dramatic has been the decline in the unemployment rate.
It's now the lowest it's been in 50 years, just 3.5%. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Another set of numbers came out today from the U.S. Department of Labor. Import prices were up a bit in September. Most of that increase was driven by oil prices. And today, there is another reason that price may go up more. Iran said one of its tankers was struck by missiles as it was steaming through the Red Sea today. Details and confirmation are still forthcoming, but if true, this would be the latest in a string of tanker attacks. It's a worrying time to be in the business of delivering oil in the Middle East. And so the industry, the shipping industry, is taking extra precautions and raising shipping and insurance prices to reflect that risk in perhaps what's the most critical shipping area in the world. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
If confirmed, this would be at least the seventh attack on an oil tanker since May in the Middle East. Now, it's always a dodgy neighborhood, but lately it's getting worse, says Andrew Kinsey. He's a marine risk consultant at Allianz.
I feel it's an extremely concerning escalation of tensions in a region that has a very small room for error.
He says oil ships are being urged to defend against mine, missile, or pirate attacks.
You're looking at higher speeds, daylight transits, checking in, giving voyage plans so people know where you are, and trying to be that hard target.
Higher risk means higher prices to rent tankers in the Persian Gulf. It's the choke point for 30% of the world's oil supply. Last week, a tanker rental cost $85,000 a day, says maritime analyst James Jang at Aegis Capital. But today?
So this is what I'm hearing from the ship brokers. They're the middleman between producers and the shippers. The chatter around the rates right now is $200,000 to $300,000 per day.
And then there's insurance. Oil vessels have to pay their insurers what's called a war risk premium at times like this. And that premium has shot up, says Matt Smith at Clipper Data, which tracks global oil flows.
Since those events in May, we've seen war premium for vessels in the Middle East rising tenfold. We should likely only see those increasing as these incidents continue to occur.
Despite the nervousness on the oceans and higher shipping and insurance rates, the price of oil hasn't spiked. There are many factors in play there, including weak demand. But Smith worries that tensions with Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United States could yield more tanker attacks and potentially miscalculation and broader conflict. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
California now, where the state is giving more workers the right to sue their employers over sexual harassment, discrimination, and wage theft. Yesterday, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill that outlaws forced arbitration. That's when a company requires workers to give up their right to take their employer to court for violations, instead forcing them into third-party arbitration. The widespread use of these agreements has come under fire as the Me Too movement has gained steam. From our Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
30 years ago, requiring an employee to settle disputes in arbitration was incredibly rare. Today, more than half of non-union private sector workers have to sign these deals in order to get or keep a job, says Heidi Shearholtz with the Economic Policy Institute.
It is very common in low-wage workplaces, and it is also more common in industries that are disproportionately composed of women and African-American workers.
Companies say keeping disputes out of court avoids long and costly litigation, but there's another reason, says Jennifer Hasselberger, who once directed arbitration disputes for the Catholic Archdiocese in Minneapolis.
It kept messy employment disputes out of the public eye.
For that reason, the practice has increasingly come under scrutiny for its role in silencing workers and perpetuating a culture of abuse. Research also shows it's more likely to favor businesses and award less money than a court jury.
I think there was really a sense of betrayal because the system is really stacked against the employee.
California joins a growing list of states, including Washington, New York, and Massachusetts, that have attempted to put an end to forced arbitration. But those efforts have faced legal challenges from businesses, and the businesses have been winning, says Deepak Gupta, an attorney who has argued arbitration cases before the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court has made it really difficult for the states, or really anyone other than the U.S. Congress, to solve this problem.
Last month, the House of Representatives passed legislation that would ban this type of forced arbitration across the country, but it hasn't been taken up in the Republican-controlled Senate. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they help get groceries or pay for household bills.
How young adults are scoring that deal on rent. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets advanced on that positive news about trade between China and the U.S. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 319 points, 1.2% to close at 26,816. The Nasdaq was up 106 points, 1.3% to finish at 8057. The S&P 500 gained 32 points, 1% to close at 2970. For the week, the Dow added 0.9%, the Nasdaq also up 0.9%, the S&P 500 up 0.6%. Chip makers with exposure to China clicked upward. Intel improved 1.9%. NVIDIA added 1.6%. Micron Technology jumped 4.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.73%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rima Khres, host of This is Uncomfortable, a new podcast from Marketplace that explores the thing we're always in our feelings over, but don't really know how to talk about. Money. This is a storytelling podcast that digs into things like how someone can feel like an imposter when they move from one socioeconomic class to another, or why so many people lie about what's in their bank account. We'll even teach you how to ask everyone you know about how much they make. But just to be clear, this is not a personal finance podcast. It is a podcast about life and how money messes with it. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Rising sea levels, along with more severe storms and higher tides, mean places that have rarely or never flooded are flooding now. And when you're making the huge financial decision of where to buy a house, you might want to know what climate change means for your flood risk. We have digital tools that make it easy to hunt for a house, even shop for a mortgage, but try to find out the future flood risk of a piece of property, and all of a sudden, your options are way more limited. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has this story.
When Brian Rankin first saw his house on Maryland's Eastern Shore, he had an immediate emotional reaction.
I just fell head over heels in love with it. It's truly a unique house.
It's got all glass walls, and it looks very futuristic in an 1860s kind of way. It's got a big screened-in porch, a dock, and it's close to the water. Really close.
It's closer than is now permitted. It's 80 feet from the water, and right now all structures have to be 100 feet from the shoreline.
Rankin's an actuary. That means it's his job to think about risk. Yet, he wasn't really thinking about climate-related flood risk when he bought this house. He loves boating and swimming, and this was a vacation home that his kids and grandkids could enjoy, ideally for generations. So he bought it. He spent 3 years renovating it. Then one day, his wife pointed him towards a website that showed their waterfront houses, well, quite vulnerable to sea level rise.
I didn't look at it very closely because it's worrisome.
You actually didn't want too much information.
No. I'm sorry, you're right, I don't. Because to be honest with you, I worry that I don't worry enough. And so, you know, it's like only so much I can handle.
It's a growing business to help people understand this kind of risk. Right now, there are bigger companies focused at the institutional level. Two of them, Jupiter Intelligence and 427, both based in the Bay Area, collect and sell data. And there are little guys, too.
Well, I think that most people don't know that we exist.
Albert Slapp is the CEO of Coastal Risk Consulting, a startup in Florida. 5 years ago, he joined forces with scientists to translate global climate data into custom-made reports for individuals. Here's what they're based on.
An algorithmic software that takes big data and crunches it in the Amazon cloud down to the property level.
The technology can build profiles of the natural hazard and climate risk for every piece of property in the U.S. Real estate investors, governments, insurers, and, yep, individual homeowners buy the reports. They come with maps and color graphs showing the risk. It's a more readable and more comprehensive alternative to the federal government's flooding maps. Here's Melissa Roberts of the nonprofit American Flood Coalition.
What homeowners had to rely on was the FEMA maps, which are really an alphabet soup of flood zone designations that are really confusing. So you would look it up and see, you know, I'm in A or AE or C or V.
That alphabet soup of government-identified flood zones was actually meant for the insurance industry, not regular homeowners. The maps are hard to understand, and they don't reflect projections of sea level rise or heavy rainfall. Robert says there's a huge opportunity around this information gap.
You could easily see something added into a Zillow or a Realtor.com that had, you know, a 1 to 10 scale telling you what your flood risk could look like.
And people who already own a property with some flood risk might pay for more information. We bought a report from Coastal Risk Consulting, $49, to assess risk on that glass vacation home on the riverbank in Maryland. Brian Rankin read through it.
I'm looking at the first page, and I know right away that, you know, this is my property. You know, you can see our dock that juts into the river.
When he gets to the page on tidal flooding, it predicts his property will deal with it, well, pretty much every day by the year 2034. So what's he going to do now?
That is a great question. I mean, I just finished the place. I want to enjoy it. But then you think about what's going to happen. Like, you know, It's an odd thing to have a second home. It's like you're blessed. If you have a place on the water, you're just lucky. But when you start thinking long term, you know, looking at this map and seeing what's going on in the world, it probably will be a bigger factor in selling it than it was buying it.
As climate change becomes more tangible, climate data could play a bigger role in the real estate market. That can complicate buying and selling a house, even for one that's love at first sight. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
You can hear more of our climate and technology reporting as part of our series, How We Survive, on the Marketplace Tech podcast. Now, of course, where you buy a house only matters if you can buy a house. A decade after the Great Recession, young adults are living with their parents at nearly record high rates. Instead of a crumbling economy driving people into their folks' basement or spare bedrooms, it's now soaring housing costs, forcing millennials and now Generation Z adults to hold off on getting their own place. In pricey California, nearly 40% of 18 to 34-year-olds still live with a parent. Matt Levin from the news site Cal Matters explores this new normal in the next installment of our Adventures in Housing series.
It's a Saturday night at Patsy's Irish Pub in Mission Viejo, a wealthy part of Orange County in Southern California. Patsy's looks like a lot of other California bars in 2019. Off-key karaoke, a crowd of people vaping outside, and plenty of 20 and 30-year-olds who still live with their parents. Drop a Coors Light in this bar, and some of the beer is bound to splash millennial still living at home.
I'm here right now getting drunk with my mom.
Jacob Ostheimer is 24. He lives with his mom and stepdad. So does his wife, who right now is on the dance floor with the rest of his family.
We had an apartment here for like 2 years, but I was spending like $30,000 a year in rent. And I could have had that in my savings right now.
In this pricey part of Orange County, 55% of 18 to 34-year-olds live with at least one parent, one of the highest rates in the state. Like Remy Adams. She's 25, and her parents invited her and her boyfriend to live with them.
I think they're going to be sad when everyone moves out.
Everyone also includes her older sister and her sister's boyfriend.
We have a downstairs bedroom. Everyone's upstairs. They really stay out of our way and don't really, like, care what we do.
Ostheimer and Adams are saving up to buy a house of their own one day. Mission Viejo's median home value is more than $700,000, according to Zillow.
Increasing housing costs make it harder for young people to launch.
Jessica Hardy is a professor at Hunter College in New York who studies family living arrangements. She says multi-generational housing is also very common among lower-income families who pool together resources to afford rising rents.
They often also pay some sort of rent towards their parents. They help get groceries or pay for household bills.
That doesn't necessarily mean everyone gets along, though, says Megan Nagendink, a couples therapist based in Sacramento.
They're in that maybe teenage bedroom that one of them grew up in, and they can feel uncomfortable. So communication goes downhill.
As Sacramento home prices have jumped in recent years, Nagendink has seen an uptick in young adult couples dealing with the stress of living with baby boomer parents.
What I have seen a lot is that couples are actually just having a lot less sex when they're living at home.
Though in a pricey place like California, moving out of your parents' house is no guarantee your love life will improve. Ian Baker works two jobs here in Orange County, one of them at this bowling alley. He's 29.
I've been out of my mom's for a little over a year now.
And how many dates have you gone on in that year?
Absolutely zero.
Baker has two roommates. He pays about $700 a month in rent.
Living with my parents, it actually wasn't that hard to try to meet girls and whatnot. Honestly, it became harder when I moved out just because of the fact that in order to move out, you know, I had to start working two jobs.
The irony isn't lost on Baker, but he does have a step up on one of his roommates, the one who lives in the living room.
Well, I mean, like I said, at least I have a door. He doesn't, so I think it's a little bit harder for him.
And hard for lots of young people facing the new normal of shared housing. A lot of young couples who come to Bowl are there just to get a break from their parents. In Orange County, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, courtesy of the Unicode Consortium. Those are the folks who help computers and phones and tablets, all the tech products, speak the same language, including picking out new emojis that will show up across devices. Now, this week, the group, for the first time ever, released a ranking of the most popular emojis showing up in messages all over the world. Of course, the classic smiley face is pretty high up on the list, although so is the sobbing face. But to leave you with a dose of optimism for the weekend, the top emojis on the list, the heart and the crying laughing face. Me, personally, I'm a big fan of the hug emoji, as everyone who's ever texted me knows. Okay, we've got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 319 points, 1 2/10%. The NASDAQ was up 106 points, 1 3/10%. The S&P 500 gained 32 points, 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.